As Ramon entered the simple dwelling, he was reminded forcefully of the cottage at Buenaventura in Cuba. He felt immediately at home here, with the trade winds in the palms and the ocean breathing heavily on the white beach below his window. He was exhausted. This deep bone weariness had accumulated over the weeks and months. As soon as Raleigh Tabaka left him, he dropped his combat uniform in a heap on the mud floor and crawled under the mosquito net. The gentle warm gusts of the trades through the open window billowed the mosquito net and caressed his naked body. He felt replete. He had performed a difficult but infinitely worthwhile task with skill and success. He knew that he had earned new honours and rewards, but none would be as satisfying as this deep sense of achievement that buoyed his weary spirit. His creation surpassed that of a Mozart or a Michelangelo. He had used as his raw materials a land and a people, mountains and valleys and lakes and rivers and plains, and millions of human beings. He had mixed them on his palette, and then in blood and flames and gunfire he had fashioned and worked them into a masterpiece. His creation surpassed that of any artist who had lived before him. He knew that there was no God, at least not as the bishops and imams whom he had so recently disciplined and humiliated imagined God to be. The God that Ramon knew was of this world. He was the twin god of power and political mastery, and Ramon was his prophet. The work had only just begun. First a single nation, he thought, and then another and another, until finally an entire continent. His elation staved off sleep for a few minutes longer, but as he succumbed, his mind took another turn. Maybe it was the hut and the wind and the sound of the sea. Whatever the association of ideas, he thought of Nicholas. In the night he dreamt of his son. He saw again his shy, reluctant smile, and heard his voice and his laughter in his head, and felt the small, warm hand curled in his hand like the timorous body of a tiny creature. When he awoke, the longing was even more intense. While he worked at his desk, the image of his son's face receded, and he could concentrate on the coded messages from Havana and Moscow that flashed down from the orbiting satellite. However, when he stood up from his desk and looked down through the open window to the beach, he imagined he saw a slim, tanned little body splashing in the green surf and heard the sweet treble cries of the child. Perhaps it was merely a reaction from the slaughter in the streets of Addis Ababa, or the memory of the corpses of the sons of the Abuna, with their eyeballs hanging on their cheeks and their immature genitals stuffed into their mouths. But over the next few days the desire to see his son became an obsession. He could not leave Tercio Base now, not with so much in play, so many prizes at stake on the great gaming board of Africa. Instead, he sent a satellite message to Havana, and within an hour had his reply. After Ethiopia, they would deny him nothing. Nicholas and Adra were on the next transport flight from Cuba. Ramon was waiting at the airstrip when the Aleutian landed at Tercio Base. He watched his son come down the ramp. He walked ahead of Adra, no longer clinging to her hand like a baby. There was alertness in the way he carried his head, a spring to his step, and a sparkle of curiosity and intelligence in his eyes as he paused at the bottom of the ramp and looked about him keenly. Ramon felt an extraordinary emotion, an intensification of the longing and pride with which he had anticipated the boy's arrival. No other human being had ever moved him in this way. For long, aching moments, he watched his son in secret, concealed in the throng of disembarking troops and swarming porters, his eyes hidden behind sunglasses. He was reluctant to give a name to this emotion he felt. He would never have entertained the word love. Then Nicholas picked him out. He saw the boy's entire attitude change. He started forward at a run, but within a dozen paces he took control of himself. The look of extreme pleasure on his lovely face was swiftly masked. He was expressionless as he walked calmly to the side of the jeep in which Ramon sat and held out his hand. "Good day, Padre," he said softly. "How does it go with you?" Ramon felt an almost irresistible compulsion to embrace him. He sat very still while he overcame it. Then he took Nicholas's hand and returned his formal greeting. Nicholas rode in the front of the jeep beside his father. Adra sat in the back. They skirted the guerrilla camp on the way from the airstrip to the beach compound, and Nicholas could not contain his curiosity. He asked the first question hesitantly, in a subdued voice.
"Why are all these men here? Are they sons of the revolution like we are, Padre?"
When Ramon replied without any sign of irritability, the next question was bolder. When the reply to that was also friendly, he relaxed further and took a lively interest in everything around them. The men at the roadside saluted Ramon as the jeep passed. From the corner of his eye he saw Nicholas stiffen in the front seat and return the salute with all the aplomb of a veteran. Ramon had to turn his face away to hide his smile. The men had noticed it also, and grinned after the departing vehicle. When they arrived at the compound, Ramon's orderly had a batch of satellite messages for his attention. However, there was little of importance amongst them, and Ramon dealt with them swiftly. He went to the hut alongside his own that he had allocated for Nicholas and Adra. He heard the boy's excited chatter as he stepped up onto the stoop, but it was cut off abruptly as he appeared in the doorway. Again Nicholas was strange and withdrawn, watching his father warily.
"Did you bring your bathing suit?" Ramon asked him.
"Yes, Padre."
"Good. Put it on. We will swim together."
The water inside the reef was calm and warm.
"Look, Padre, I can swim the crawl now. No more baby paddle," Nicholas boasted.
With Ramon swimming beside him, he made it out to the reef, with only a half dozen pauses to tread water while he regained his breath. They sat side by side on a coral head, and while they discussed seriously how the reef was formed by millions of tiny living creatures, Ramon studied the boy carefully. He was well favoured, tall and strong for his age. His vocabulary had expanded again since they had last been together. At times it was almost like talking to a grown man. They ate dinner together on the veranda. Ramon discovered how much he had missed Adra's cooking. Every minute Nicholas seemed more relaxed. His appetite was good. He asked for more of the baked mullet. Ramon allowed him half a glass of well-watered wine. Nicholas sipped it like a connoisseur, swelling with pride at being treated as an adult. When Adra came to fetch him to bed, he slipped off his chair without argument, but pulled away from her hand and came around the table to his father.
"I am very happy to be here, Padre," he said formally, and held out his hand.
As Ramon shook his hand, he experienced an actual physical constriction of his chest. Within a week, Nicholas had become a favourite at Tertio Camp. Some of the ANC instructors and recruits had their families with them. One of the wives was a trained primary school teacher from the University of the Western Cape in South Africa. She had set up a school for the children in the camp. Ramon sent Nicholas to take part in the classes. The schoolroom was a thatched building with open sides and rows of benches made of roughly planed native timber. Almost immediately it was clear that Nicholas was as bright and advanced as children 3 and 4 years older than he was. English was the language of instruction, and he made swift progress in it. He had a clear, sweet voice and led the singing. He taught them Land of the Landless and the other revolutionary songs, which the teacher translated into English. He had brought his soccer ball with him, and this gave him tremendous social prestige amongst his peers. A work detail from the camp, under orders from Colonel General Machado, levelled a soccer pitch for the school, laid out the markings in lime, and set up goalposts. Such was Nicholas's prowess on the field that they nicknamed him Pele, and the daily matches became a popular feature of camp life. As the general's son, Nicholas had special standing and privilege. He had the run of the camp, including the induction classes for new recruits. The instructors allowed him to handle the weapons. Ramon watched with carefully concealed pride as his son stood up before a class of adult recruits and demonstrated the stripping and reassembling of an AK-47 assault rifle. Then he took his place on the range and fired a magazine of live ammunition. 12 of the 20 rounds struck the man-sized target at which he was aiming. Without Ramon's knowledge, José, the Cuban driver, taught Nicholas to drive the jeep. The first Ramon knew of his son's latest accomplishment was when Nicholas, sitting on a cushion, proudly drove him down to the airstrip to meet the incoming Aleutian transport flight. The men along the road cheered them as they passed, with cries of Viva Pele. The camp tailor made Nicholas his own set of camouflage combat fatigues and a soft Cuban-style cap. He wore the cap cocked at an angle over one eye, just as his father did, and imitated Ramon's mannerisms, lifting his cap to rake his fingers through his hair, or hooking his thumbs in his belt as he stood at rest. He became Ramon's unofficial driver, and wherever they went, huge grins of delight followed the jeep. On some afternoons, Ramon and Nicholas took one of the boats powered by a 50-horsepower outboard motor and raced out through the pass in the coral reef into the blue Atlantic waters. They anchored the boat over one of the deep reefs and fished with hand lines. The coral teemed with fish of every possible shape and size and color. Ramon taught Nicholas how to chop the carcass of a large fish, preserved from their previous expedition, into a fine mince. They mixed this with beach sand to make it sink swiftly and ground-baited the reef below the anchored boat. Soon they could make out the shadowy shapes of large fish darting and swirling in the blue depths 60 feet below their hull. The scent of the ground-bait that goaded them into a feeding frenzy. As they dropped their baited hooks amongst them, the thick line was jerked through their fingers and Nicholas squealed with glee. The reef fish glittered and glowed with peacock blue and iridescent green, with clear daffodil yellow and startling scarlet. They were spotted with jade and sapphire, striped like zebra and splashed with flaming ruby and opal. They were shaped like bullets and butterflies and winged like exotic birds. They were armed with daggers and barbed spines and rows of porcelain white fangs. They squeaked and grunted like pigs as they were hauled flapping and squirming over the gunwale of the assault boat. Some were so large that Ramon had to give Nicholas a hand to drag them from the water. He hated anybody, even his father, to help him. He hated even more to stop fishing at the close of the day. "One more, Padre, just one more," he cried eagerly. And in the end Ramon had to take the line out of his hands. One evening they stayed later than usual. Darkness was falling as they hauled the anchor and started the outboard. The trade wind had turned chilly, and the wind of their passage blew over them as they bounced over the tops of the swells on their way back to the river mouth. Goose flesh pimpled Nicholas's arms as he hugged himself. He shivered with cold and exhaustion and the reaction from so much excitement. Steering the boat with one hand, Ramon put his other arm around Nicholas's shoulders. For a moment the child froze with shock at his unfamiliar touch, and then his body relaxed, and he crept closer to his father and cuddled against his chest. As he steered through the darkness with the small, shivering body pressed to his, Ramon was assailed once again by the memory of the Abuna of Addis Ababa's sons propped against the front wall of their father's home with empty eye sockets, and each with his tiny dark penis protruding like a finger from between his dead lips. Ramon was not touched by either guilt or regret. It had been necessary, just as once it had been necessary to half-drown the child that now cuddled against his chest. Duty was often hard and cruel, but he had never flinched from its call. Still, he had never felt before the way he did now. They beached the boat and handed it over to José, the Cuban driver, to care for. Then they made their way by lantern light through the palm grove towards the stockade of the compound. Nicholas stumbled against him in the darkness, and Ramon took his hand to steady him. The child made no effort to pull his hand away. They walked on without speaking, until they reached the gate of the compound, and then Nicholas whispered softly, "I wish I could stay here at Tertio with you always." Ramon pretended he had not heard him, but he found it difficult to draw his next breath. The signals clerk woke him 10 minutes after midnight. It needed only a light tap on the door of the hut for Ramon to come fully awake, with a Tokarev pistol in his hand. "What is it?" "A red rose relay from Moscow," the clerk answered him. They had strict instructions to call him at any time of the day or night for a red rose communication. "I will come immediately." The message was in code, and Ramon fetched his copy of the code pad from the steel safe. They used a one-time pad, a separate code randomly generated by computer for each sheet. He and Red Rose had the only existing copies of the pad, and used a single sheet for each message. He matched her sheet and began to decode the message. "Project is codenamed Skylight," the message read. "First subterranean test of 30 megaton fission device, scheduled October the 26th. Test site located 27 degrees 35 minutes south, 24 degrees 25 minutes east. Full specifications of device on hand." Ramon sent his driver to the main ANC camp upriver, and Rally Tabaco was in his office within 40 minutes.